What's the date today?
26.
Hi, this is Joshua Hodel Spafford. I'm 35. It's April 26, 2008. And we are in the StoryCorps booth in Grand Central Terminal. And I'm here with my friend, Mark Nelson.
Hello, it's Mark Nelson again, and this is part three of our same discussion. I'm 40 years old. Today is the same date, April 26, and I am also here in the Grand Central Terminal. Okay, ready?
I think so.
So, we were just talking about this before we started. We're just going to take 2 seconds here to clarify some things from our past two tapes.
All right.
So these are very bullet cleanup, house cleaning time.
Let's do it.
From the tape on March 21, I just wanted to say that I noted that George Hodel Sr., that is your grandfather's dad,
yeah,
married Esther Hodel, which obviously is not correct. He didn't marry a woman named Esther Hodel. He actually married a woman named Esther Leoff, which is sometimes pronounced in the Americanized Leoff. And according to Steve, Esther was a dentist in Paris before she came over with George, again, around 1901 or 1904.
Yeah.
On the second tape from April 9th, I define the word curément as old slang for abortion. And I'm not really an expert on the etymology of words, but I think it's more accurate to say that curément is actually arcane language, Americanized French probably. And what it really means is a DNC or a dilation and curettage, which is a procedure used in abortion sometimes.
Okay.
So the spirit of what we're talking about is correct, but actual words I chose are not correct. And again, I'm not an expert in medicine, but a dilation and curettage doesn't necessarily mean abortion too. So on the DA transcripts, your grandfather might actually be talking about just doing DNCs, which... I know we'd have to think about that a little bit more. Steve is convinced now because he gets into these kind of belief systems that what he's talking about is abortion.
Right.
So I just want to be on the record as saying he might be talking about abortion.
Appreciate that.
And then I thought it would be really fascinating just to give a few examples about how your grandfather chose to name his children. Because we didn't really... I went back and found my notes on that, because we didn't give really great examples last time. So John Dion Hodel,
yeah,
Steve's twin who died at childbirth,
mm-hmm,
was named in honor of your granddad's close friend, John Huston, the film director,
mm-hmm,
and then also for the Greek god Dionysus.
Mm-hmm.
Steve himself is named for Stephen Daedalus, the protagonist of James Joyce's Ulysses,
right,
which was the book that George and Dorothy read on their honeymoon. Michael Paul Hodel.
Easy reading.
Yeah, exactly.
Peach time reading.
A lot of time on their hands. So. Michael Paul Hodel was named for a family friend named Paul de Cruyff. I'm not sure if I have that pronunciation right. But he was the author of what was then a very important book called Microbe Hunters, which I have also not read.
Huh.
I don't know anything about that book.
I didn't know that.
And then George made Dorothy's name into an affectionate contraction of Dorothy and Eros. He called her Dorero. Man Ray also calls her that in a note on a picture that he inscribes to them,
right?
Which suggests a certain closeness.
Mm-hmm.
And this discussion got started because we were discussing Tamar and the incest trial.
That's right.
And I told you that Tamar was named for the Robinson Jeffers poem, Tamar.
Do you know that to be true, that she was named for that, or it just happened to be that that poem existed, and we're assuming that?
No, that's exactly what I'm going to clarify for you, because I did notice a very subtle thing when we were talking last time where you said, if that might be where her name comes from.
Right.
You know, so...
Because I don't know. I only recently discovered that work, and
right,
so I brought it up. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you this, which will help you in... You can choose whether to believe it or not.
Right.
But let me just tell you this, that Tamar's middle name is Nais, which, again, I'm not sure how she pronounces it. I guess I should have asked her, which, again, I think has either an old French or a Latin root for born, so you can think of the word Renaissance. So one way to read her name is Tamar born Hodel, which is also related to a mythology or the Naiads, and these were, forgive my pronunciation if it's bad, these were fountain nymphs that could sometimes represent revenge for offenses and lead an offender to madness. Now, in getting to the truth of her name, whether or not, you know, we talked about whether George named her for a poem about incest and then went on to have incest with her. Again, we talked about how a skeptic might think that's crazy.
Right.
But just to add some solidity to that so that it's more clear, Tamar's daughter is also named Fauna. Mm-hmm. And she's the one who was given away to the Black family. She was born in August of 1950. She is also named for Robinson Jeffers' poem called Fauna, because she loved her name, came down from George, that she was named for the Robinson Jeffers poem.
Who tells you this?
Tamar.
Tamar tells you this.
Called her on the phone last night.
Okay.
Because I found my old notes, and I had never even thought of it before. I never even thought of it as important.
Right.
Like, you know, big deal, another name for a Robinson Jeffers poem. But that there is actually a poem in the same book as the poem called Tamar, and it's called Fauna. And it's from the book, 1925 book called Roan Stallion, Tamar and Other Poems. So if you're trying to yourself determine what that means for you, you might also consider that here she is naming her own daughter. And she says, no, George had nothing to do with this name, but she's also naming her daughter for a poem from the same book.
Interesting.
So for what that's worth. Okay. You have anything to add to any of those points? Anything you want to clarify from your last tapes?
Not in this moment. Just that since we talked last, and specifically about the importance of naming children, I just reflected a lot upon that since then, and just remembered a whole lot more. And it was very important in our family, the giving and bestowing of names, and it started with him, and it's something of a tradition that the entire family, at least on our side, had taken up. And I may have brought this example up a few times, but for example, my own mother, Diane, was allegedly named for an old flame of George's, and my grandmother, in retaliation, I think, named her next son Ramon after a flame of hers, and that was something of a source
of conflict.
Did
that play itself out?
It did a little bit. And
you remember this, or is this just part of your lore?
It's part of the family lore, if you will. And I was named for, my name is Joshua Mark, and I was named for my uncle, and. For example, George really had an active part in all this. When the grandchildren came into being, myself, for example, he would approve a name or not. In fact, one of my younger sisters, Sharon, I don't know what had gotten into my mother's head, but she initially had the notion that she would name her Sharon, C-H, and Grandpa heard that and. She was named that, in fact, right. And he said that it changed. Had to be changed immediately because that was the boatman across the River Styx. So, even to the end, he was very active. But let's proceed.
Okay, sure. Then I realized just for posterity, and we're talking about this. You call him an epic man, and it's just clear that no matter where you go with George Hodel, it's an epic, awesome story. I mean, of madness and crazy. I mean, I don't mean that he was mad necessarily. I just mean that it's maddening to you find yourself going down one trail and then all of a sudden you find yourself going down another trail and you come back to the same trail. So it's like you said, it's obsessive. Who is your grandpa? So what I thought was important for these tapes is because we've talked about so many things, just briefly give a very quick timeline of, you know, the case that Sarah and I are making and the time period that we're talking about. So I'm going to do that very quickly, and if you have anything to add, of course, please jump in. May 9th, 1945, George Hodel's secretary, Ruth Spalding, dies under what we now know for a fact to be suspicious circumstances. We also think or know, according to Steve Lopez's column in the Times, Los Angeles Times, that is, that the police were investigating Hodel for possibly having murdered her. Hodel talks about this event on the transcripts. He doesn't refer to her by name, but he talks about the event. That's 5 years later. May 10, 1945. This event is called a suicide in the Evening Herald Express, and listing overdose of sleeping tablets as the cause. January 15, 1947. Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia, is found dead. As we already know, Hodel later becomes a suspect in her death. November 20, 1947, the article I mentioned in the last tape where he's claiming $25,000 against a Chinese sacrificial tablet, that's actually after the Black Dahlia murder. That's November 20, 1947. On the last tape, I said that was beforehand. I don't know if that's relevant in any way, shape, or form. I have no idea. Sometime in July of 1949, the incest incident at the Franklin House occurs. Bear in mind, I'm calling him Hodel here, even though I know that he's your grandpa, just to be brief. Hodel allegedly gets Tamar pregnant. In September, Hodel allegedly arranges for an abortion to be performed on Tamar. October 5, 1949, Hodel is arrested on incest charges. October 6, Hodel is released on bail and the story hits the papers. October 11, 1949, Dr. Francis Ballard and his assistant Charles Smith are arrested for performing the abortion on Tamar. And their trial was held in January 50, 1950, after Hodel was acquitted. And then another woman we're going to talk about here, Lillian Lenorak, testifies on behalf of both Ballard and Smith. And she allegedly perjured herself, claiming that she was present with Tamar at Ballard's office when he examined Tamar, but said that no abortion was performed. That's her testimony at the trial for incest. In the Unkerfer letter, which we'll talk about in a minute, this is the testimony that she threatened to recant and go to the DA with and say she lied. But based on Tamar's previous label of being called a pathological liar, with Lillian's perjured testimony, the judge finds the doctor and his assistant not guilty. October 28, 1949, a report by Jemison notes that from an original pool of 316 suspects, 209 have definitively been eliminated as suspects, 107 remain as suspects. Jemison notes that after examination of the files and evidence, it appears that the investigative effort should be continued and concentrated on the following suspects: Leslie Dillon, Mark Hansen, Carl Balsinger, Glenn Wolfe, Henry Hubert Hoffman, and Dr. George Hodel. So he's one of six people that they're still actively pursuing. December 8, 1949, he goes on trial for the incest. December 24th, 1949, he's acquitted and given 3 years probation for contributing to the delinquency of a minor. Monday, January 30, police officer Mary Unkerfer writes to the Los Angeles district attorney about an incident that she witnessed at the Hodel home involving Dr. Hodel and Lillian Lenorak. I'm not sure of the date of this incident, but it had to have happened prior to Wednesday, January 25, because Unkerfer notes that she was sorry she wasn't there for them when they came to visit her on that date. This means that only one month after the acquittal, George is in big trouble again. February, and then I just want to clarify the dates of the transcripts, which we discussed last time. February 18th, 1950 to March 27, 1950. The Los Angeles district attorney plants microphones inside Hodel's home, and the recordings have disappeared, but the transcripts or officer's notations, some combination of the officer's notations and the transcripts remain. Shortly after this, George closes up shop and leaves town for Hawaii. So we're talking about a significant period between 1945 and 1950 where your granddad's in trouble.
Yeah.
Whether he killed the Black Dahlia again, I'll state, I don't know. But it's clear that he's mixed up in some big bad business.
Yeah.
So that's my timeline.
Thank you.
I think that will also help you as you kind of, you know, you said last time you didn't quite.
It's been difficult piecing
it all together. So this maybe will help you just sort of kind of block it in.
It does.
Have any thoughts on this?
They're summoning up old demons. It's just hard to, you know, I've been living with this for 5 years now, I guess it is. Mm-hmm. Time flies really quickly. and I always think I'm making some sort of progress in my relationship to it, and more importantly, what the implications are to myself and my family.
Yeah.
And I wake up one day and I think, oh, it's getting better. I've got my head wrapped around it, or I have some objectivity, and I can discuss it, or I can make art about it, or I can share or laugh at it. And then the next day I'll look at it again, and I'm just always amazed that it's still after all this time really wields quite a wallop.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed hearing that timeline just now, and in the course of our conversations I've been trying to look at it a bit myself, trying to really imagine what at least those 2 years must have been like for George. Whether or not he's guilty, it sounds pretty awful.
Yeah.
to live through that amount of stress and surveillance and pressure, and that's not a man I knew. Like, I didn't, he's a young man, he's in his 40s, I think, and I didn't know that guy.
Yeah.
It's incredibly surreal for me to try to, I don't even know why I've been doing it, but I have, but I've been trying to imagine what's been going on, and I've been looking at the transcripts of the conversation, and that's another rabbit hole, just to, you're given the, almost the shell of the behavior in a way,
mm-hmm.
you know, phone calls and hearing typewriters go off, or sounds of fornication in the bedroom, or who knows what, and it's kind of a curse that we're only given the transcripts, because I have so much conjecture as to what's actually happening.
Right, because you're missing intonation, you're missing,
right,
you know, tone of voice.
Right.
You're missing, it's like you're like, you put your fingers up to the glass, but you can't get through it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, I find that I'll read a swath of that transcript, and upon one reading, it's just, you can read it as some gleeful, diabolical man laughing at his own, you know, at his powers of being a criminal mastermind. That's one take, and then you could reread it again, or I can, and I'll say I see a really incredibly nervous man who's releasing stress and needing to talk and cope and laugh, and you know, there are two sides to every coin.
Yeah, it's very complicated.
It's very complicated. So I'll just wrap up a quick reaction. You said, how do I feel about listening to that? I feel bummed out.
It's true.
Really, you know, really bummed out.
It's one of the hardest things about kind of getting to know you, and actually the personalization of this StoryCorps thing is that, you know, when Sarah and I are writing the book, you don't exist for us. This
right.
is abstract in yeah. a way. I mean, we've got Steve, but Steve is his own kind of caricature of himself to us in a way. I don't mean that rudely.
No.
I simply mean that we are forced to take an objective distance to Steve.
Yeah.
Because Steve has a whole plethora of other issues going on
yeah.
that are conflicted, and a bunch of belief systems that we don't agree with. So to personalize this is a drag in a way. It's like, I don't want you to think I'm rubbing your nose
oh,
in it, like,
of
you know,
not.
Like, you
I,
know, like, look at the shit your grandfather was
I've
into.
I've never thought that, Mark.
Yeah, no,
no.
I realize that.
I actually, I've welcomed this opportunity to commiserate. And it mostly, it's been a venue for me to process my own thoughts in a way that I probably never would have done anyways, in a much more detailed manner. And I can only speak in the moment and off the cuff, because I, you know, obviously I can't plan what I'm going to say coming here, but I do want to say one more thing. Like, how do I feel about that? And this is a complete tangent.
Okay.
And this is maybe just going to relate to the overall theme I'm having in response to this conversation and to this whole topic. And that is, when I hear that, just like I hear anything in regards to this case, what I really think about is not so much me. What I think about is my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about my uncle and my aunt and my grandmother and I am sad for them. Because I can bear the life. I can reflect upon the life that I've had, which has not always been easy, mm-hmm. and it's been big and weird and epic and difficult sometimes. But I can take it with a pinch of salt. I'm glad of having it had a very eccentric life.
Yeah.
But I after our last conversation, I called my mother and I'm pressing her with questions. I don't even know why, but in the end, it boils down to the fact that my mother had a complex father,
right.
and I get the sense that she may not have had the amount or degree of love and fathership, if you will, that she wanted. And that just makes me look at her life and her behavior and how that affected me in a new way. And maybe I'm projecting, but I see, and if my mother ever hears this, I can only say this, Mom, with no malice or any kind of terrible intent, other than this is just what I see, and I see a direct relationship between the kind of relationship she had with her parents, mostly George, and perhaps the choices she made in my early life. And I'm not blaming, but it seems clear to me, and I might be projecting. So...
Okay. Well, let me.
Yeah. You know. So there's a reaction.
All right. Well,
and it might be a little coded, but
I
feel good. I feel good in having the opportunity to say that. I'm sorry. Okay. Let's keep talking.
Okay. Well. Here's. I think this would be a great example to sort of help get to the bottom of this. Last time we talked about the two pictures in the photo album that was given from George to Steve. And so if we're going to go back to the backstory, let's go back to those pictures for a minute, because there's something huge here, and I just want to share it with you, because as we talked about, Steve is given this little photo album. He calls it the Talisman. And in it are these two pictures. And this sets him on a path of saying, aha, I recognize her. That's Elizabeth Short, the Black Dahlia. Dad must have done it. Now, we talked about the fact that the story doesn't work on a number of levels. So that's already on record. We've already talked about that.
And it should be noted that we're not the only ones who think that.
Absolutely. But there's a much bigger point here, which
right.
I want to make, which
okay.
gets it's a very complicated one. It's multifaceted,
okay.
but it gets back to your family and,
right.
and the interpretation of these two photographs.
Okay.
So I talked to Tamar on the telephone last night because I wanted to be clear that it was okay to relate this story now. But basically, the identity of the girls is always in question. Around about January of 2006, February, March, I'm not really good with times and dates. I have to go back to them and think about them
yeah.
a lot. But somewhere in there, we're in the heat of writing the book,
yeah.
our book, Sarah and I. And Tamar sends me a letter written by Hortensia, sent from Steve to her. And this letter is a very elegant letter, lays out the case why Steve is wrong. But, I mean, I'm amazed that she could even write the letter, but it's a very elegant letter.
Yeah.
And in that letter, she identifies, she can't do it by name because she can't remember, but she identifies one of the girls.
Yeah.
We should clarify that there are two pictures, and in his first printing of his book, Steve says that both pictures are the same girl, and that's Elizabeth Short.
Yeah.
Hortensia's saying, no, that's not her. This is another girl. I know her. She's a Filipino girl.
Filipino-American girl, yeah.
Right, and she was in the movies. And we're just going to be careful to protect her identity here, so
okay.
I'm not going to say her name or anything
right.
like that. So earlier, when I was interviewing Tamar, she told me, no, I met that girl. I know that girl. That girl is not the Black Dahlia.
Right.
I met her at the Franklin House in 1940, whatever,
right.
48 or 9 or something. I'm not supposed to know at this point that Tamar's given me this letter. Okay?
Right.
But I've talked to Tamar now, and she said it's fine to relate this story.
Okay.
A little bit later, but in that letter, she tells me the movie that the girl is in as a bit part, as an extra.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, there might actually be a picture of this girl.
Right.
So I mentioned last time that I'm okay with the pictures in the sense that I just let them be. What I meant was I let them in Steve's book be the narrative device that impels the story forward. That's only half of where I'm coming from.
Okay.
The other half is, wow, here's a chance to figure out who that girl is. I'm going to go rent that movie right away.
Right.
So I go rent that movie. I make a screen grab. I find the girl. What I think is the girl.
Yeah.
The Filipino girl in a sea of Asian girls. But there's a girl that looks to me just like the girl in the picture. So I make a screen grab of that and I send it on to Tamar. And she goes, yeah, maybe. I think so. I'm not sure. Maybe. Bear in mind, there's a whole bunch of girls in this shot.
Right.
She doesn't have any lines or anything like that. So now I'm kind of stuck. You know, I've taken the confidence of Tamar. I can't tell Steve she sent me the letter because I always keep my word. The only reason I'm saying it now, like I said, is she said it's okay. A few months later, right as the galleys are going to press, Steve sends me the same letter.
Mm-hmm.
This gives me a window. I call up Steve. The book, it's really too late at this point because I didn't want to get into an interfamilial problem, you know, with Steve and Tamar and Hortensia and all this business. It's not my job to, like, get in a mess with them, you know. So Steve sends me the same letter. Now I've got an opening to say, Steve, Hortensia is saying she knows this girl. This girl was in a movie. Tamar is saying she knows this girl. She met her at the Franklin House. This is two grown adult women both telling you that they've seen that girl. Steve's answer to me was something along the lines of, well, Hortensia's got an agenda, and Tamar, well, she's too young to remember. Now let's just dissect that for a minute. So Steve gets to take Tamar's remembrance that the police were watching the house in 1947 and use that in his book.
Right.
But when she tells him that she met the girl, suddenly she can't remember. So I would say to Steve, you don't get it both ways, man.
Right.
Either she remembers and has a great memory or she doesn't. Right. But I would also say to Hortensia, you know, here's Tamar, who could be just blanket supporting Steve's story, saying, no, that girl's not the Black Dahlia. I remember that girl.
Right.
So which is it?
I get
it. Is Tamar a liar? Or is Tamar someone who's willing to tell the truth when necessary? So these pictures meet at an intersection of intent, of truth, of interpretation. And there's a lot that starts this thing down the path.
Yeah.
So just to cut this story a little shorter. So then... crazily enough, that girl is watching TV one night, Dateline or something, one of those shows, Anderson Cooper, I'm not sure which one. And
yeah.
And there's Steve showing his photo album, and she says, that's me. And so Steve goes to meet her. So we now know that one girl has been identified, and that is not the Black Dahlia. She shows him some other pictures that George took of her. He does, in fact, say that, she does say that, yes, that's me, and here's another one from the same series.
Huh.
So we've got one girl completely eliminated. Now, if you go to Steve's website, he's still, you know, and I feel for him. You know, he's built a belief system around these pictures.
Right.
And he hasn't taken that one down yet. And I'm still saying that's not her. And, you know, pretty much everybody else is. But Steve, it's okay. Steve's got a belief system. It's.
But the problem is the inciting incident for this whole thing was the smoking gun of it.
The pictures.
Was the picture. And so it's really unfortunate for him, possibly, that's been disabled.
Well, no, I don't think so. Because what I say to him is, you don't need the photograph. Let go, you know, let go of the photograph.
Right. But in the way he presented the whole thing was...
Exactly.
Was front and foremost, which to me just opens up another huge can of worms. And that... the short version of that is, I don't know if we've talked about it, maybe we have, is that I find it incredibly hard to believe that you are a young boy growing up with your dad and in 60 years not to know that he was a suspect in one of the biggest murder cases in American history.
Me too.
And to conveniently just not know that and then to suddenly come across a bit of evidence which gives you what you think to be an original theory. I just don't believe that. I don't know that he's outright lying, but you remember things from childhood. Things stay with you, you know? I won't go too far down that path, but so it's so complex.
Yeah.
It's like, is the gesture, the smoking gun of the book a lie, or is it an excuse, or what is that? What is that behavior? And more importantly, why does it exist? What is he trying to do?
And then more importantly than that even is he pushes this into the public consciousness. And then all of this other stuff comes out where you just can't believe it. And it keeps adding up. It keeps accumulating. He's got an amazing new document on his website that's a real document. He's redacted it again to protect people's privacy. But just reading the document, it's crazy. You know, it's George causing another woman this sort of emotional trauma and pain by telling her she's got gonorrhea, and she finds the courage to go to another state, her home state, and get it rechecked. And the guy says, no, you don't have gonorrhea. And, you know, and she seals this up and waits for it to be released after her death. Now, what's going on there? So, yeah, you can talk about Steve and the intention and the complicated nature of what he's doing, but he's clearly opening up some kind of can of worms that's so huge. It's so many worms in the can, you know, that
it's a multi-generational
yeah
can of worms.
Well, maybe if you'd humor me here, let's we have about what, 8 minutes to 7 minutes.
Is it all right if I ask a question?
Sure. Yep.
I was just wondering, so Steve is your mother's brother then?
Yeah.
So you were saying that he kind of says that he didn't know anything that was going on as a child. Did your mother ever talk about what she knew was going on when she was a child?
No, my mother, well, let me change that. Yes. And we're talking about two different events. There's the event of the alleged incest between my grandfather and my aunt Tamar. And then there's the murder of the Black Dahlia. I can't even say it. I can't even articulate that. And I grew up with the topic of the alleged incest as very much a part of family lore. And it was just the ghost in the room that was always there. And my part of the problem is that we were able to love Grandpa, and she was able to our whole family was able to embrace him and love him by completely renouncing Tamar as a liar. That's the only way that we've been able, that we could proceed. Like, what other option is there? Right. There is no other option.
Right.
If you're to be a quote unquote a happy family.
Right.
So the idea of the Black Dahlia only came out much later, and you know, it was even after it was before she was born. But now she's obvious. She's very much.
It's important to say that Tamar, the Black Dahlia, does come up at the incest trial, which means that at the very least, Tamar has and she's 10 years older than Steve. There's a clear, clearly Tamar knew there was some relationship between George and the Black Dahlia. Not that he killed her, but that it had been brought up at her trial, or that he was a suspect in it.
Right.
Tamar knew that. So now you're going to say that 20 years go by and Tamar never told that to Steve. I don't know what.
Case as notorious as it was.
Right.
That
his name
aspect didn't float out there somehow.
Right. Okay, let me just, I got to change the subject.
I know.
It's a non sequitur, but we only have 5 minutes left.
Okay.
So I was really hoping to get to the Lily
Let's
and Lenorak letter, but we got so much to talk about. But let me just, I've got to ask you something, because Seth came to see me from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And he told me, this is your playwright partner, mm-hmm. and he told me that you know, Sarah and I went to see your play, and there's a very small moment in that play where you get a gift from your grandfather. And it's so fantastic that I actually thought, well, this is just some fiction they wrote. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Can you please tell me about that?
In our play version, I'm given a gift as a young boy.
This is not a fiction, though, in real life, correct?
Well, it's a little bit of both. And the play, it's not pretending to be fiction or nonfiction. It's being presented as both.
Right.
In the play, I'm given a doctor's bag full of surgical instruments. And they're presented in the play as a huge bundle of very ornate and possibly macabre instruments. I don't know. In actuality, I was given a gift of... I've been given many gifts from George all my life, and I value them, and clothes and books and magazines. My first gift was, in fact, a doctor's bag with a microscope and some surgical instruments in it. Yeah.
Gynecological instruments?
That I don't know to be true.
But a scalpel?
Certainly doctors, typical doctors.
A scalpel? Knives?
What do you call that thing? I'm blanking.
Oh, yeah. For the heart?
Yeah. There's so, no scalpels. There were no knives in there.
Okay. Seth made it sound like it was this, you know, full gynecological kit.
So. No, that is not true.
Maybe he was just, you know, but in his own play at the moment.
No, that is not true. But okay. I was given, my first gift was a doctor's bag with a microscope and a bunch of doctor's standard tools, a little hammer and the... And there were, you know what these things are, the knee and all that.
Okay. So this is not nearly as pathological as I had it made out in my head to be. So.
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Do we have 4 minutes left? Can we do it? Okay. All right. So our moderator, is that the right word? Facilitator. I don't know. I get blanked out on that. Jenna.
Weiss-Berman
is going to play a little acting role here. And she's going to read a letter that's, I think... An incredible document. It's from the police officer, Mary Ankofer, 1950.
January 30th, 1950, District Attorney's Office, Los Angeles, California, 209 West Valerio Street, Santa Barbara, California. Dear Sir, I am sorry I missed the gentleman from your office on Wednesday. I work at odd hours, and I arrived at home about 10 minutes after your... something left for Los Angeles. I had expected to come to Los Angeles early this week as I had business to attend to there, but find it is not necessary for me to make the trip except to give you what information I can regarding the woman whom I brought to Santa Barbara from the home of Dr. Hodell on Franklin Avenue. Mrs. Hamilton, mother of the young woman, asked me to go to Los Angeles to get her and her baby. I called Dr. Hodell before I left Santa Barbara to make sure the patient was at his home and there would be no chance of me running into a snag when I got there, as it was night and I was not prepared to have to look for her. Dr. Hodell told me that it was very necessary for her to be removed from his home that same evening, as he intended to put her on an institution in Los Angeles if she was not immediately taken back to Santa Barbara. He informed me that two of her friends were there and that they would return to Santa Barbara with Lillian to keep her from becoming too much of a problem on the way. When I arrived at the Franklin address, I took a young woman with me. I sensed something wrong as soon as I entered the building. The doctor seemed very anxious to tell me that the girl was in a bad mental condition and that she had attempted suicide. I asked where the parties were who were going to ride to Santa Barbara with me, and he said he could not get in touch with them at that time. But when I assured him that I would not take the girl with me unless her friends would go along, he then called the woman, Karum Tutikian, who came to his home and said she would go with me. The two men volunteered to drive another car and followed me to see that I got the girl safely home. Joseph Barrett, who lives at the same address on Franklin, and another young man friend who was not interested in the case except that he offered to drive Barrett up here and then take the woman and the other man, Joe Barrett, back to Los Angeles. When I asked to see Lillian, Dr. Hodell explained that I had no need to worry about her giving me trouble on the way to Santa Barbara. He stated that he had given her a large enough dose to keep her asleep for 3 hours. With the aid of the Mexican maid, who looks like a half-wit or a hophead, we packed Lillian's clothes, and it was about 10 p.m. before we got away from his home. Dr. Hodel and Joe Barrett took Lillian to my car, holding her up on both arms. That weakened her, and she began to tell us about the doctor. She talked a great deal about her relations with him, and she stated that she was very much afraid of him. She said she had witnessed an abortion performed on his own little girl, and then she stated that he had threatened to have her child taken away from her if she did not testify in his favor in court. She said he knew of some of her foolishness in connection with the man called Charles, and that the doctor was holding that over her. She said that she had never attempted suicide and that she had never cut her wrists or her hands. She stated that the doctor constantly gave her drugs and that when she wakened, the cutting had been done. While I was in the doctor's sitting room waiting for the woman who was to drive with us, I asked the doctor what he had caused the girl to go haywire so suddenly. She said it was a great deal to do with some case she had in court. It was not until I realized what case it was that had caused her so much worry. There were scratches and bruises on her forehead and arms. Her 3-year-old baby said the doctor knocked his mommy down and made mommy cry hard. On the way north, the car with the young men in drove behind us, and it was after I left Lillian at the FICO ward at the GEM hospital that I had a chance to talk to Joe Barrett. He stated emphatically that there was nothing wrong with Lillian except what had been brought on by the cruel treatment received from Dr. Hodel. He stated that he knew Lillian had perjured herself at the trial because the doctor had her under his influence. He stated that the relations between the doctor and his child were terrible and were worse than I had any idea. He stated that the doctor boasted that the $15,000 he paid Jerry Geisler was used to influence the district attorney, and that was how the doctor was cleared of the charge against him. He stated that Lillian had fallen in love with Charles, and that Charles was an assistant to another doctor, a friend of Hodel. When I asked Barrett where this Charles was now living, he stated he had taken off after the doctor's trial and was in San Francisco. Lillian stated that she had a very guilty mind after the trial and told Hodel that she was going to tell the district attorney that she had lied on the witness stand, and that Dr. Hodel told her if she squealed that he would name Charles and the other doctor as being the ones who performed the operation. Joe Barrett spoke of Dr. Hodel as being a real no-good guy. I visited Lillian at the hospital on Sunday, yesterday. She seemed glad to see me and stated that she would like to tell me all about the true facts concerning the doctor's activities and the trial, but she stated that she knew he would have her done away with as well as her baby. She said she would like to have told the men from your office all about it, but she said she was not sure if you were her friends, and she was just plumb scared to tell for fear he would carry out his threat to have her boy taken from her and to have her committed to an insane institution. This morning, I went to the hearing at the FICO ward, and it was determined that she is mentally upset. The doctor said a deal of the condition was brought about from the strain of the trial. Both doctors stated they felt she should have medical care, so she is to be taken to Camarillo State Hospital for treatment. My personal opinion is that if the feeling between her and her mother was not so strained, she might have been given a chance to go home and to be taken care of by her mother. There seems to have never been love between those two. The mother takes the attitude that she is going to make Lillian do things the way she, mother, wants them, and the girl seems just as determined that she is not going to be always treated as a child. Hence, there is fireworks between them. Joe Barrett and Karun Tutikian were here from Los Angeles to attend the hearings. Joe has had a good chance to talk to Dr. Hodel, and he knows the district attorney's office is interested in the case. He seems to be afraid he might be questioned about the trial because his whole attitude was changed. He now speaks of the doctor not as a bad fellow with plenty of worries of his own. he spoke and acted as though he is sorry to be as sorry he opened his mouth the night I brought Lillian home from Los Angeles. Karun Tatikian's address is 22 II South Highland, dancing teacher. I do not know that this information will be of any help to you. It is about all I could tell you if I came down personally. But if there is anything I can do to help, if anything that is good and sincere, I am at your service. Very sincerely, yours, Mary H. Unkifer.
It's pretty incredible.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So we're probably out of time. Okay, thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
So we'll pick it up there next time.
Yeah.
Okay.